I'd like for us to consider, how active is God? How involved is God in the nations? We know that God doesn't change. And from the teachings and the prophets of the Old Testament, we find that God is heavily involved in the governments of various nations. We see that all the way through the prophets. If it's true then, well, then we can expect it to be true today. We may not have God telling us his perspective like he told us in the Old Testament, but the lack of information doesn't mean it's not happening. And so I'd like for us to take a look at some of the things that God has done in the past and see that God does involve himself in the world. Assyria was a very ancient nation. It survived nearly 3,000 years. Under Tiglath-Pileser, Assyria began a period of rapid expanse and became a world empire. Tiglath-Pileser invaded Syria and Palestine, and that way expanded his borders. And under Shalmaneser, which is about 727 BC to 722 BC, and then later under Sargon, which was 722 to 705 BC, that's when they took over northern Israel. They was overthrown. They were taken off into captivity under those two kings in Assyria. And Judah was threatened while King Hezekiah was reigning. But there God intervened, and that's recorded for us in by Isaiah. But I want you to take a notice that God made use of Assyria. Assyria was merely an instrument in God's hand, an instrument for destruction. Take a look at Isaiah chapter 10. Isaiah chapter 10, and we're going to start at verse 5. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I sent it against the godless nation and commissioned it against the people of my fury, to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like the mud in the streets. That's what God says. This is just a tool in my hand. And yet, while it's being used by God, it doesn't mean that Assyria recognized God. In fact, as far as Assyrians were concerned, they were just doing what Assyrians do. In verse 7 of the same chapter, it says, yet it does not so intend. It doesn't intend to be a tool of God's, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. All it cares about is conquering. It's not there trying to help God. It doesn't care about God. But God says, this is a tool in my hand. And even though God was using Assyria for his ends, it doesn't mean Assyria was guiltless. God was making use of it, but because they were doing it because that's what they wanted to do, God could hold them accountable. So in chapter 10, look at verse 12. So it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I punished the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. For he has said, by the power of my hand and by the wisdom I did this. For I had understanding, and I have removed the boundaries of the peoples and plundered their treasures. And like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants. And my hand reached into the riches of the people like a nest, and like as one gathers abandoned eggs. I gathered all the earth, and there was not one that flapped his wing or opened his beak or chirped. See, Assyria, from his point of view, the king's point of view, look at all the great things I did. I'm so great, I'm so wonderful, I'm so grand. For that, God said, I'm taking him down. He was being used by God. But God said, when I get done with him, he's not worth keeping around. Did you notice how many eyes appear in those 13 and 14? Assyria took notice of God. The king operated as he thought fit. But take a look at what God says in verse 15. Is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That would be like the club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. Therefore the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors, and under his glory a fire will be kindled like a burning flame. God says the very idea that Assyria thinks is so mighty, it's almost laughable. Like a tool using the one who's wielding the tool. It's the other way around. And so God told Judah, well, you just have to be patient until that day comes. In verse 24, thus says the Lord God of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you the way Egypt did. For in a very little while, my indignation against you will be spent and my anger will be directed to their destruction. Just be patient. Yes, you're getting punished. But when that's done, I'm going to take out Assyria. And it really wasn't all that long before God did rescue Judah. In 2 Kings chapter 10, 2 Kings chapter 19, I should say. 2 Kings 19, and in verse 34. For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. Then it will happen that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men rose early in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. So Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. And it came about that when he was worshiping in the house of Nishrak, his god, that Ebramelech and Sazareh, killed him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Arat, and Eshahadan, his son, became king in his place. God carried it out. He wiped him out, killed him, and just for a little extra irony, he killed him in the idol of his, the worshiping of his own idol. Now, a century later, Zephaniah predicts the ultimate end of this Assyrian Empire. In Zephaniah chapter 2 and in verse 12, you also, O Ethiopians, will be slain by my sword, and he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and he will make Nineveh a desolation, parched like the wilderness. Flocks will lie down in her midst, all beasts which range in herds. Both the pelican and the hedgehog will lodge in the tops of her pillars. Birds will sing in the windows. Desolation will be on the threshold. For he has laid bare the cedar work. This exultant city which dwells securely, which says in her hearts, I am and there is no one besides me. How she shall become a desolation, a resting place for beasts. Everyone who passes by her will hiss and wave his hand in contempt. And Nahum actually describes the fall in Nahum 1, verse 14. The Lord has issued a command concerning you. Your name will no longer be perpetuated. I will cut off idol and image from the house of your gods. I will prepare your grave, for you are contemptible. And for 2.5 millennia, Nineveh has been buried in the wastelands. It was hidden under the sands. Only recently it was found by archaeologists, relatively. It's been gone. And it was the mightiest empire of the world at the time. Now let's talk about Babylon. See, God used the Babylonians to overthrow the Assyrians. Nebuchadnezzar of the Chaldeans from 626 to 604 BC is the one who began the assault against Nineveh. His son Nebuchadnezzar, starting at 604 to 526 BC, completed the task in his very first year of reign. He destroyed Nineveh. And before the rise of Nebuchadnezzar, Habakkuk came to God with a problem. And if we go to chapter 1 of Habakkuk, he says, "Why do you make me see iniquity," in verse 3, "and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contentions arise. Therefore the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore justice comes out perverted." Lord, we got a problem. There's so much wickedness going on. And God's answer is, well, I have a plan for that. He plans to use the Chaldeans to punish Judah, who has slid into such sins. In verse 5, "Look among the nations, observe, be astonished and wonder, because I'm doing something in your days. You would not believe it if you were told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people, who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs." This was long before the rise of Babylon. But God says, I'm going to use the Chaldeans to do this. And at the time God declared it, he said, people wouldn't guess that such a thing would even happen. But if God raises up a nation to punish the wicked, the question is, can that nation be guilty? Look at verse 11 in chapter 1. "Then they will sweep through like the winds and pass, but they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God." Yes, God's making use of them, but they're still responsible for their choices. Now this puzzles Habakkuk. Why would the righteous God use a wicked nation to punish God's people? Verse 12, it says, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed them to judge. And you, O Rock, have established them to correct. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Why have you made men like fish in the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net, and gather them together with their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they offer a sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing net. Because through these things, their catch is large and their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? Why are you using the Chaldeans?" But God makes it clear in 5 pronouncements of woe that the Babylonians would be punished just like the Israelites. Because God looks at what they do and not who they claim to be. Take a look at chapter 2, verse 6. Will not all these take up a taunt song against him, even mockery and insinuations against him, and say, woe to him who increases that which is not his? For how long? And make himself rich with loans? Will not your creditors rise up suddenly, and those who collect from you awaken? Indeed, you will become plunder for them. And then in verse 8 also, because you have looted many nations, all the remainder of the peoples will loot you because of human bloodshed and violence done into the land, to the town and all its inhabitants. Because they plundered the nations, God said, I'm going to plunder them. Now look at verse 9. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to put his nets on high, to deliver from the hands of calamity. Their arrogance. Look at verse 12. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. Is it not intended for the Lord of hosts that peoples toil for fire and nations grow weary for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as waters cover the seas. And then in verse 15, woe to you who make your neighbors drink and who mix your venom even to make them drunk, so as to look on their nakedness. You will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. You yourself will drink and expose your own nakedness. And the cup of the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will come upon your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and the devastation of his beasts by which you terrified them, because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town, and all its inhabitants. And then finally in 18, what profit is the idol when the maker has carved it, or his image the teacher of falsehoods? For his maker trusts in his own handiwork, and he fashions speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a mute stone, arise. And that is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all inside it. Notice that the woes are in general terms. People with these characteristics will face God's wrath. And there's no arguing with God. In fact, in verse 20, he says, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. And the Chaldeans came. And in 587 and 586 BC, Judah was carried off into captivity. And among those captives was Daniel, who rose to prominence in the Babylonian Empire. And the stories were encouraging to the people. But we should not overlook that a major theme of Daniel was that God rules over the nations. So take a look at Daniel chapter 2. Daniel 2, and in verse 21. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. When Nebuchadnezzar had his dream that none of his magicians could interpret or say what it meant, Daniel declared that this was what was being meant. God rules. God decides. Later on in Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he had another dream in chapter 4 and verse 17. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and bestows on it whom he wishes, and sets over it the lowliest of men. God decides. And years later, when Nebuchadnezzar died and Nabonidus was king and his son Belshazzar was ruling in Babylon, Daniel was called in to interpret some writings on the wall. And he reminded Belshazzar of these same events. In chapter 5, verse 21, Daniel 5, verse 21, he is also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like a beast, and his dwelling place was that of the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. And so when Babylon served God's purpose, it too was overthrown. Take a look at Jeremiah chapter 51. Jeremiah 51 and verse 11. Sharpen the arrows, fill the quivers. The Lord has aroused the spirit of the kings of Medes, because his purpose is against Babylon to destroy it. For it is the vengeance of the Lord, vengeance for his temple. Babylon served God's purpose, but is now going to answer to its choices. In fact, nearly 200 years before this, in advance, God declared through Isaiah what was going to happen. 200 years beforehand. Take a look at Isaiah 45 and in verse 1. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus his anointed, whom I have taken by the right hand, to subdue nations before him and to loosen the loins of kings, to open doors before him so that the gates will not be shut. He names the man who's going to lead the Persians and the Medes. And yet he also is just a tool who doesn't know he's being used. Take a look at verse 5 in Isaiah 45. I am the Lord, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you have not known me. And it was told long in advance so that people would know who was in control. Take a look at verse 6. That men may know from the rising to the setting of the sun that there is no one else besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I am the one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things. Drip down, O heavens, from above, and let the clouds pour down righteousness. Let the earth open up and salvation bear fruit, and the righteousness spring up with it. I, the Lord, have created it. God is in control. He told about this long in advance so that people would see God does exactly what he chooses to do. Now, clearly, God raised up the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Medes for purposes. And even though they didn't know they were being used, God made use of them. And they committed crimes, and they were held guilty for the crimes they committed while they were being used. God is in control. So take a look at Isaiah 46 and in verse 11. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country, truly I have spoken it, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, surely I will do it. God uses the righteous, but he also makes use of the most vilest man if that serves his purpose. So I want you to consider that when Jesus stood before Pilate, being on trial, Pilate thought he was in charge. In John 19 and verse 10, so Pilate said to him, "You do not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you, and I have the authority to crucify you? Don't you know that I'm in charge? I hold your life in my hands." Notice what Jesus says in answer to that. Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. Now, Jesus was handed over to Pilate by Caiaphas. Both Caiaphas and Pilate were abusing their power. Pilate said repeatedly, "This is an innocent man," but he didn't let him go. Caiaphas was making up charges against Jesus. But Jesus says that Caiaphas has the greater responsibility. It was required by God for the purpose of freeing mankind from sin that Jesus died on the cross. These men had roles to play in that. But they're being held responsible for what they chose to do. But no power, including Pilate's, existed without God's approval. Take a look at Romans chapter 13. Romans 13 and in verse 1. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Now today, Jesus holds all authority. In Matthew chapter 28, Matthew 28 and verse 18. And Jesus came up and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." That's why he's called in Revelation chapter 1 and in verse 5 that he's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Take a look at Revelation 1 verse 5. "And from Jesus, the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, the ruler of the kings of the earth." And take a look at Revelation 17 and in verse 14. "These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are called the faithful chosen and are the called and chosen and faithful." Jesus is Lord of lords. He rules. In chapter 19, in verse 16, "And on his robe and on his thigh he has the name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." In Jesus, just before his death, he describes the destruction of Jerusalem by Rome. In Matthew chapter 24, and he borrows imagery from the prophets to emphasize that he is in control of the nations. In Matthew 24, verse 27, "For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather." It's going to be seen by everybody, from one end of the world to the other. They'll see what Jesus said was going to happen. "It will be done with power," in verse 29. "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the skies, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, when all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they'll see the Son of God coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one on the end of the sky to the other." He has power that these Jews did not recognize, but didn't matter. Those same type of terms are used when speaking of the Egyptians, when God was going to overthrow them. If you take a look at Isaiah chapter 19, look at verse 1 and 2. "The oracle concerning Egypt. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. The idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. I will also incite the Egyptians against Egyptians, and they'll fight against his brother, and each against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. God is causing civil war to occur within the Egyptians. But the imagery is of him riding in on a swift cloud. You can't stop a cloud. And it comes fast. And that's God's war horse, in a sense, in the imagery. In that same chapter, we go down to verse 11. The princes of Zoan are mere fools, and the advice of Pharaoh's wisest advisors has become stupid. How can you men say of Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, a son of the ancient kings? Well then, where are your wise men? Please let them tell you, and let them understand that the Lord of hosts has purposed against Egypt. Sometimes, you know, nations think that they're smart. All God has to do is turn off the smartness in the advisors and just watch the nations make stupid choices and bring themselves down. In Isaiah 13, speaking about the Babylonians, in Isaiah 13 and in verse 11, thus I will punish the world for his evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. And we turn over to Jeremiah chapter 4, as God describes what he's going to do to the Babylonians. Jeremiah 4 and verse 19. My soul, I'm in anguish. Oh, my heart is pounding in me. I cannot be silent because you have heard, oh, my soul, the sound of the trumpet, the war, alarm of war. Disaster on disaster is proclaimed, for the whole land is devastated. Suddenly my tents are devastated. My curtains is in an instant. How long must I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? For my people are foolish. They do not know me not. They are stupid children. They have no understanding. They are shrewd to do evil, but to do good they do not know. And I looked on the earth, and behold, it was formless and void. And as to the heavens, they had no light. Now, he's not talking about literally that there's, you know, the world suddenly lost its form and lost all its light. He's saying God's overriding the whole order of the world to accomplish his means. And we jump to Ezekiel chapter 32. Ezekiel 32 and in verse 7. And when I extinguish you, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light. All the shining lights in the heavens I will darken over you, and it will set darkness on your lands, declares the Lord. He's taking out all the wisdom. He's taking out all the knowledge. He's taking out all the leaders. There's no one to guide. That's what he means by taking out the lights. Just as God used the nations to punish Israel in the past, Jesus is saying, I am bringing the Romans in to destroy Jerusalem. And I'm going to take out all the lights. I'm going to take out all the leadership. I'm going to come and you can't stop me. I'm going to come on this cloud. Everyone's going to see it like lightning striking. And what we have to understand is it continues today. God opposes the wicked. In Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And over in Ephesians chapter 5, take a look at verse 6. Ephesians 5 and in verse 6. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. And over in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. Colossians 3, verse 5. Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which mounts to idolatry. For it is because of these things that the wrath of God will come upon the sons of disobedience. God holds the people responsible for their sins. Those governments were created by God. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. If God made them, then they are under his control, to be used as instruments of his wrath, to accomplish his purpose. And even in a crumbling, decaying world, such knowledge should give us encouragement, because Christ's rule is absolute. Sometimes we wonder, well, what's going to happen? We see things going downhill. We don't need to worry. God will take care of these things. I hope you'll think about these things. If there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, we always leave an opportunity available to become a child of God. The baptistry is prepared. It was repaired from last week. And if there is a child of God and would like the prayers of their brethren on your behalf, we also leave that opportunity. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song selected.